Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Realty Speak, the podcast where we dive deep into the nuts and bolts of the real estate world, offering you insights, answers, and real-world stories designed to help you elevate your real estate investment strategy. I'm your host, Bill Widener, and today, Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, we are recording from the Times Square, Manhattan, New York office of Abrams, Garfinkel, Margolis, and Bergson. And my very special guest is managing partner of the firm, Neil Garfinkel. Many of you may already be familiar with Neil through his esteemed role as broker counsel to the Real Estate Board of New York, where he offers indispensable legal advice to many of the city's premier real estate professionals while also expertly representing clients across a wide spectrum of situations in the real estate domain. In today's episode, we're delving into a topic that's often misunderstood, yet crucial, fair housing laws. When I looked up the definition of fair, the dictionary presented it as marked by impartiality, honesty, free from self-interest, prejudice, or favoritism. It's a definition that resonates deeply with Neil's fair housing expertise, and today he will unpack for you why understanding fair housing laws is not just important, but essential, and how neglecting these laws, whether inadvertently or deliberately, can lead to dire consequences. Neil, thanks for being here today for me and the Realty Speak audience.
Thank you, Bill, for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to sit, talk with you, talk about fair housing, which I'm obviously very passionate about. So I'm looking forward to our episode.
Diving into this topic is always timely, but it's particularly pertinent now, given that it's April, Fair Housing Month. Isn't that right, Neil?
Yep, it's Fair Housing Month, and we're doing lots of things to demonstrate our commitment to fair housing.
Give me a little history on that, Neil.
I've been broker counsel to the Real Estate Board of New York for the last 17 years. Just taking one quick step back, my firm is 29 years old. I worked at a big firm, a big real estate firm, worked for a small real estate law firm, and then ultimately started my own firm. And one of the things that I did when I first started, and I like to tell this story, is I had no clients. So real estate attorney, have no clients. What am I going to do? And it occurred to me that if I work with real estate agents, might be a good way of building a business. So I was very fortunate. I went to the Long Island Board of Realtors, and they were nice enough to help me get certified to teach. I started teaching their classes. And then for the next 12 years, I worked with LIBOR. I was the chair of some of their committees. 17 years ago, so that was the first 12, 17 years ago, the Real Estate Board of New York reached out and they asked me to be what was called broker counsel. It started out as residential counsel. It's now called broker counsel. And so I host a legal hotline every day for REBNY members. I write two columns a week. One is called Fair Housing Fridays. And about 15 years ago, I started teaching their fair housing class. I created their fair housing class. What's interesting about that, Bill, is that when I first started teaching, if I taught fair housing, two or three times a year. It was a lot. I am teaching fair housing now. I teach once for REBNY, once for LIBOR. I have a three-hour recorded class through the Real Estate Center for Success, which we give away to anyone for free. I am teaching fair housing, I don't know, six times a month now. So it just shows you how it's changed. Newsday did an article in November of 2019 called Long Island Divided.
And Newsday is the Long Island newspaper.
That's correct.
It's like what the New York Times is in the city to Long Island.
That's exactly correct. And they came out with this expose, investigative reporting. For 3 years, they did what's called pair testing. And the results of those pair testing showed significant issues of fair housing on Long Island. Recently, they did a follow-up to that, and I was interviewed. I actually, if you look on their website, there's a video of me being interviewed. And I was asked, well, Neil, do you think that as a result of Long Island Divided, things have changed? And my answer was, definitely. If you look at the way that fair housing is taught now, the awareness, the importance of it, not to minimize the importance previously, but the short answer is yes. It made a big difference. Lots of laws have changed, but I know even my awareness and the way that I teach and so on was definitely dictated by that. Yes, it's Fair Housing Month, and we are doing something with the Division of Human Rights this month. We're doing a panel on source of income and disability. REBNY has the Fair Housing class, the Real Estate Center. We encourage anyone to take that class for 3 hours of CE credit. There's no charge. just reaffirm the importance of fair housing. It's not the Fair Housing Month. It's Fair Housing Day. Every day is Fair Housing Day. When we talk about Fair Housing Month, yes, it's important, but the truth of the matter is it's important every day.
Right. So we're shining a light on it this month in April, but really it's important every day, like you said. In the beginning, I mentioned that it's a misunderstood topic. There are some people that don't believe that fair housing laws apply to them, that it's mostly for real estate brokers, but that's not correct, is it?
Interesting. The law says that it applies to housing providers, and it applies to people that are in a position of making a decision with regard to fair housing. And the truth of the matter is, I say, well, no, when I'm talking to my constituency, an owner, a broker, it doesn't matter, everyone in your organization should be trained in fair housing. Because if you think about it, when someone goes to a building and they ask the door person, who lives here, for example, that's a question that they really shouldn't be answering. It's very likely that's going to violate fair housing laws. So I take the position when I do my training that fair housing laws apply to everyone, as they should. And I want to make two points because you're saying it's misunderstood, and I agree with you. The laws have become very complex, and their application is complex. And so I'd like to think that the training that I do is not about someone wants to violate fair housing laws. They don't care what I say, right? But I'm concerned about the groups, the brokers, the owners that don't really understand fair housing laws. And that's why I dedicate myself to doing that. The other thing is when I teach, I talk about the why of fair housing. And let's talk about that for a second. Why is it so important?
Yeah, why is it so important? And also in New York State, we actually, if not the most stringent fair housing laws, very close to the most stringent fair housing laws in the country. Is that true?
I think that is probably a true statement. I'm a member of the Association of Real Estate Licensing Law Officials, and I sit on their Fair Housing Committee, and it is interesting to see that in fact, other states don't have nearly as stringent fair housing laws as New York State. So there are federal fair housing laws, then there are state and local fair housing laws. If you look at New York as a whole, yes, we have significant amount of fair housing laws.
And does the city go beyond that?
Yeah, it does. So let's explain that for a second. The way that fair housing laws work is it creates certain what's called protected classes. People who have similar characteristics, and by virtue of those characteristics, they cannot be discriminated against. So you could have federal fair housing laws, disability is a federal fair housing law. And then you have source of income is a state fair housing law. And then you have lawful occupation is a city fair housing law. When we talk about that, we talk about the protected classes. We have a chart that we've created and happy to share that with anyone that is interested in getting that.
Is there a link to that somewhere on your website?
We've created something called the Toolbox for Real Estate Agent Success. So it's toolbox, the number 4, success.com.
And I'll put it in the show notes. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. Talk about some of those extra protected classes in New York State and New York City.
Yeah, so before I do that, though, I want to talk about the why of fair housing. So let's go back to that.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you think, what are our most basic of human needs? We have air. We have a need for food. We have a need for clothing. And it's the next one, shelter. Shelter is one of our most basic human needs. And I think anyone can agree, and everyone should agree with me, that no one should ever be denied that most basic of human need, shelter, by virtue of what their characteristics are. And to me, that's the why of fair housing. That's why what we do. And that's why I also remind, you know, you're in the real estate business, I'm in the real estate business. And I like to remind people that we do this amazing thing every day. We help people find shelter. We help people find their dreams. And so I think we lose sight of that every day because it's so rote to us. It's just what we do every day. But we do this amazing thing. And then I join that with the idea of, if you look at fair housing, what the purpose is. Why are we doing this? Well, that's exactly why, right? We need to give everyone the opportunity to achieve that shelter, and we shouldn't discriminate based on their characteristics.
What are some of those characteristics?
Lawful occupation is a protected class in New York City. It's not anywhere else. What does that mean? I sometimes talk about the idea that in New York City, landlords used to say no attorneys.
Why would they say no attorneys? You would think they would want to have an attorney living in their property because it's a professional occupation. The income certainly supports the payment of rent. Why wouldn't they want to have them in their building?
Maybe you and I, the good guys, but what about the attorney that specializes in eviction? And I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying, though, that you that or litigation. So the landlord didn't want to engage with that attorney by virtue of their occupation. Well, in New York City, that's illegal, as it should be.
So in other words, the attorney applies for occupancy in a particular building, and the owner turns them down because the owner is trying to avoid litigation with someone that actually lives in their building. And that would happen?
I know it seems far-fetched. It used to be that there were ads that said no attorneys. But actually, it brings up an interesting point. Not all places have lawful occupation as a protected class. So in New York City, you're not supposed to ask someone, what's your position? What's your title? What's your occupation? But if you think about that, to me, that makes a lot of sense in the greater context of fair housing. Why? Well, when I teach fair housing, I talk about there's two major principles that we're interested in. The first is treat everyone the same way, treat everyone equally. And that's not only a mindset, but it's a process. So your mindset should be, I need to treat everyone the same way. And then the process that you use to qualify people, for example, also needs to be in line with that. And the second piece is look at the money. The one thing is that it's not a protected category is how much money you have. And so you should really just be focusing on, does this person qualify financially for this property? So when we talk about occupation, I would suggest to you, why is it really important what someone's occupation is? You don't know how much money someone makes. So instead of focusing on what's your title, what's your position, and so on, simply ask the question, how much money do you make? Now, source of income is a protected class at the New York State level. What does that mean? All it means is that you need to consider someone's source of income. Said differently, people just think, oh, how much do you make from a salary? But there are lots of sources of income. So New York State says, look, you as an owner, if you're making a decision about a tenant, you need to consider all of those sources of income, trust income, salary, whatever the case may be, vouchers, subsidies,
child support,
alimony, exactly, all of those things. So when you circle back, when I teach fair housing, I really focus on the strategies, the understanding. It all comes back to these two concepts. Really build a system where you treat everyone the same way and focus on the financial piece. That's the most important thing.
And this is both for brokers and owners of property owners that are using these qualifications to determine whether or not this person is financially capable of supporting the rent that they're going to charge.
Correct.
And that's it. So it actually, in some ways, kind of simplifies the process, right? Because now these are the only things that I need to look at. Income as a whole, regardless of its source, and that demonstrates the ability to make the payments that are going to be required going forward as a condition of the lease, and then I guess credit score.
Yeah, it could be credit score. I mean, when we start to get into now rental vouchers, it becomes a little bit more complicated.
Explain what rental vouchers are.
So there are various programs that could be at the federal level, it could be at the state level, it could be a local level. And depending on someone's income, they qualify for those programs. So they can't make more than a certain amount. And then there are lots of different programs. And some programs will pay the full amount of the rent on behalf of the recipient. Other programs will require the recipient to pay a portion of that amount. Sometimes that amount will cover the utilities. Other times it won't. And so the programs can be complex. For example, when you're dealing with someone with a disability, so the law says that it's up to the disabled person to request what's called a reasonable accommodation or modification. You as a landlord might not know that. You might not understand what a reasonable accommodation is. So I'm just giving you an example of how, regardless of what we talk about, things can get more complex than that. With respect to source of income, and specifically, let's call it a voucher recipient, again, there's lots of different programs. All of those programs can be a little bit different. These programs are amazing. They can be lifesavers. They can help people find homes and place and shelter where they wouldn't. The problem that I have with the programs, and I just wrote an op-ed about this, was the idea that I believe that we need to put voucher recipients on equal footing with non-recipients.
And how do we do that?
So let me explain why I say that. And this is kind of trying to simplify it. But the first thing is each voucher, the piece of paper that documents what the recipient is receiving varies from agency to agency. So you as a landlord, depending on the program, some don't even have a voucher or it's not clear on its face. So the first thing that I said is, I believe that every program agency should come together and they should create one standard form of voucher. And that voucher should simply say, landlord or real estate broker, this is what the recipient is going to receive from us. This is the portion of the rent that they will be responsible for that we've already vetted them. This covers utilities, the broker fee, and so on. So when you hand a voucher recipient, you approve them and you're saying, okay, now go find a place. It's very simple. They have a piece of paper that everyone could read, understand, and that would be the first thing.
Well, there's a lot of different voucher programs, and that's the complexity of it. And you're suggesting that they turn it into one voucher that communicates the same information to everybody all the time?
So what I'm saying is whatever they do to qualify their recipient, that's up to the program. Once they give them the ability to go look for a property, there should be a standard form of voucher that everyone could look at. Because why? Because, Bill, if I'm a recipient and you're not a recipient, right, you're a non-recipient, landlord's going to ask you a couple of questions and then you're going to be able to sign a lease. As a recipient, if I have a form of voucher that is confusing, which they can be. For example, in some cases, they can't, depending on the zip code, for example, the amount of the voucher may change. So the landlord now has to go do investigation as to what this voucher covers and so on, which is okay. But I'm saying we want to make this as simple as possible for the voucher recipient to be able to engage with that landlord and be able to move forward. And so again, how do we do that? Well, to me, you guys do whatever you need to do in terms of qualifying, but once you empower the recipient to go out and rent a property, let's make that as simple as possible. So that's number one. Number two is that every voucher requires an inspection of a property. So if we go back to the same thing, Bill, you're ready to sign a lease. You don't have a voucher. Okay, you can sign that lease in theory tomorrow. The voucher recipient still needs to engage with the landlord and have the property inspected before they can move forward.
So if the landlord says, "Well, I'm taking Bill because Bill can sign the lease tomorrow, and I'm not taking Neil because Neil is a voucher recipient, and I'm going to have this hold time where I don't even know if my apartment is rented because it has to be inspected," and they make that choice, have they violated fair housing laws?
The short answer is no. If a landlord simply said, Bill can sign tomorrow, I have no problem. I'd love to take the voucher, but Bill is signing my lease tomorrow, then Bill is going to get the apartment. And that's exactly my point.
And that's why you say put everybody on the exact same footing.
Exactly.
Because the voucher recipient, just by virtue of the way the system is designed, can't be in the same footing.
That's exactly my point.
Well, is that something that would have to happen legislatively?
It's a good question. If we had the legislature to start to weigh in on multiple levels, I think that would be very helpful. Because ultimately, yes, I think that if we're going to rely on the agencies to make these decisions on their own, I'm not sure that that's going to occur. And I'm not trying to throw darts at anyone. We can talk all day long about are the brokers are the obstructionists, the landlords are the obstructionists. They're violating the law. And I would suggest to you that a landlord, in most instances, they just want to collect their rent. They probably favor a voucher recipient knowing that they were going to get paid. Real estate agents care about getting paid too. My point is that we need those voucher recipients to be able to walk in like anyone else, hand the landlord a piece of paper, support how much they make, how much they can pay, and sign that lease. And then my third point was that a lot of the portals and a lot of the agencies, they're not even online. There's a lack of information there. We're antiquated and we need to bring that up to speed. So, because what we're seeing is that voucher amounts are getting higher. That's a wonderful thing. What's going on with our inventory right now? There is no inventory. And so we have lots of voucher recipients ready to go. They need the properties and we don't have inventory to provide that. Then add that even when there is inventory, again, you put the non-recipient versus the recipient. In most instances, the landlord is not in any way violating the law. They're just signing the lease with the person who can sign the lease tomorrow. I will be the first to tell you this is somewhat complex. I am really simplifying this, but until we start to have these conversations, we are not going to see a successful voucher program.
We talked about lawful occupation. We talked about source of income. You had mentioned disability before, and I just want to clarify that for the listeners. Were you talking about someone who has a disability and would request this reasonable accommodation prior to moving in, or someone that's already there, or a combination of both? And could you delve a little bit more into what a reasonable accommodation would be? And then I understand that it's actually the tenant that has to pay for the cost of providing this reasonable accommodation.
So let's level set. Let's take a step back. First of all, what our laws say is that you can't ask someone, so a housing provider, and let's call a housing provider, real estate agent, owner, you can't ask someone, are you disabled? You shouldn't ask them what their disability is. It's up to the disabled person to say, I have a disability, and therefore, I'd like to request a reasonable accommodation or modification. Reasonable accommodation would generally be a change to a rule. So, for example, we've got a tenant living in a building, and the building's rules say that only the tenants can use the laundry room. Well, this tenant who's disabled can't. So they have the right to say, look, I have a disability. I would like my aide or family member to use the laundry room to do my laundry. That would be a clear example of a very reasonable accommodation. There is no cost associated with that. Generally, reasonable accommodations, that would be an example, but accommodations are usually required to be, the expenses are borne by the owner. Reasonable modifications are different.
Oh, okay. So there's a difference between an accommodation and a modification.
Exactly. Let me give you an example. We have a tenant living in a building. It's perfectly legal. It's a legal building. There's no grab bars in the bathroom. The tenant says, look, I need grab bars in my bathroom. Generally, that would be a request for reasonable modification, and the tenant would have the obligation to pay for the grab bars and to put the property back to the way it was before.
When they move out.
That's kind of the distinction between accommodation and modification, a little bit different, and there's lots of law on this. So again, we would never say to a tenant, are you disabled? Now, you asked an interesting question, which is when do they have to disclose this? And the answer is they can do it at any time. They may have that need for that modification before they sign the lease, but they don't have to disclose that.
Right. And if they did disclose it and then the owner made a different decision as a result of that disclosure, then they'd be violating fair housing laws.
That's right.
Right. So the tenant is perfectly able to not disclose this, because they're not hiding anything from anybody, because they're protected by fair housing laws. And then when they move in, they say, I need grab bars. It's a reasonable modification, and the tenant's willing to pay for it. And the property owner then has to go along with it?
The answer is yes. They have the right at any time to make that request. Look, someone may not be disabled when the lease starts, but they very well may be. The law says it doesn't make a distinction based on time.
So we've talked about now those three protected classes. What are the basic protected classes that came with all fair housing laws as they were legislatively passed? And when did this all start happening?
1866 was the first, the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Color and race were the first two protected classes. And then the next one was 1968. And so there have been amendments to those fair housing laws. Protected classes have been added. Example of familial status. People confuse that. They think it's the word family. And actually, that's not what it covers. Familial status covers any group that has children under the age of 18 that is living with them. And that, I mean, that's been expanded by state and local laws, but that's what familial status is. It protects family units with children.
So if someone said, let's say they had a two-bedroom apartment, they can't say, I don't want any children.
Okay, so you bring up a different.
Oh, that's different.
Okay. Okay, so in New York State, there are exceptions to fair housing. Generally, it's 1 to 2 family property. So, Bill, if you owned a two-family and you decided that you didn't want to have children living above you. You live on the bottom floor. You would have the right to do that, provided two things: that you don't make it public. So you wouldn't say to someone, well, I don't want children, and you don't advertise it. You couldn't put in an advertisement. Similarly, if you can't make it public, you wouldn't say to a real estate broker, hey, I don't want children. You make that decision. It's a thought process, but you can't articulate it. So you can make a decision, I don't want to rent to children. The minute you make that public, though, then you have violated fair housing laws.
Now, could you alternatively say, I'm only going to rent my two-bedroom apartment above me to three people?
No. First of all, there's a couple of different reasons for that. So generally, again, I would say for an owner, if you have that one to two family, and there's some other exceptions, single sex occupancy, there's a couple of other ones. But for the most part, again, I would say to you, first of all, I'm talking to the real estate broker. I'd say, number one, tell your owner to talk to their own attorney. But I would say to you, Bill, if you wanted to do that, don't talk to anyone about it. You'll make your decision whether you want to offer a lease. Now, the other point there is that New York State, you're not required to say why I'm not offering a lease to someone. So if you decided not to offer a lease to someone, you don't have to tell them why you're doing that. The other takeaway, though, is that because you as the owner can't make it public, that means you can't talk to a real estate broker about it. So I talk about these golden rules, and one of the golden rules of fair housing for real estate brokers is that they always have to follow fair housing laws. So even if they're working with a prospective landlord, for example, that doesn't have to, they have to. They can't work together.
So then if a real estate agent is told by an owner of a property, let's say it's a two-family, I don't want to rent to people with children because they're going to be above me and the kids are going to make a lot of noise and I don't want that. That real estate agent now can't represent that owner, right? Because they're aware of this and they know that there's discrimination happening.
Correct, right? So again, go back to this golden rule. Real estate brokers always have to follow fair housing laws. So even if the owner has the right not to follow fair housing laws, the broker does. So they would say, I'm sorry, I can't work with you.
Is this true with the other protected classes?
Remember, we're talking about an exception where you have an owner that has a one to two family property. If they have more than a two family, they can't do that either. So,
they can't do that either. Okay.
Right. So, but the broker, it'd still be the same thing. If an owner does not want to follow fair housing laws, then the broker is not going to work with them. Right. I always say no commission is ever worth violating fair housing laws.
Right.
I say it's personal, professional, and financial ruin. Professionally, you lose your license. This is your profession, so you can no longer practice your profession. Personally, these fair housing cases don't start on a Monday and finish on a Wednesday. They can go on for quite some time. In fact, some of the cases that were started as a result of the Newsday article in 2019, I believe, are still going on or have just been wrapped up. So from a personal perspective, think about that being that weighing you down, wondering what's going to happen. Additionally, you have a persona. You don't want to be known as someone who violates fair housing laws. And then let's talk about the finances. The statutory fees can start at $11,000. They can go up to $250,000. I would suggest that if you don't believe me, go Google fair housing settlements and you tell me $450,000, $900,000. So again, personal, professional, financial ruin. And again, let's go back to the why. Why would you want to limit someone's ability to obtain that shelter because of a characteristic?
Quick little break here, Realty Speak fans, to take a moment to share with you that I love that you choose to listen and learn from Realty Speak. And now, with that in mind, I'd like to share that in addition to my mission to be the best real estate advisor, consultant, and broker I can be while helping you sell, purchase, and finance investment real estate, I will also help you comply with New York City Local Law 152. That's LL 152, Periodic Inspection of Gas Piping Systems. This law applies to every building, gas or not, that is not a one-family or two-family residential dwelling. That's every apartment building from three units and up, every condominium and co-op building, every hotel, every industrial building, every freestanding retail building, and more. Yes, every building except one-family and two-family residential dwellings. It's been around since 2020, and so has my company, Keep My Gas. Learn more about the law and how to comply at www.ll.com. www.ll152.myc. That's www.ll152.myc. Or I'm just a phone call away, 917-232-8529, 917-232-8529. I'll explain everything, get you a quote. So if you haven't complied yet, you can do so before it's too late. What else can I say? Solutions for real estate, it's in my DNA. And now back to the show. So before we got into this last part of the conversation, I had mentioned to you, you know, when did this start? You said 1866, and then again in 1968, and we were talking about what the different protected classes are. Would you summarize the protected classes for the listeners?
First, let me tell you how it works. We all live in the United States, and we have to follow federal law. Federal law works in that it creates these protected classes, and then states, they can't take away, they can't diminish federal law, but they can have add-ons, they could have overlays. And that's exactly what happened. I mentioned before, we started with two protected classes in 1866, race and color, and then we have an additional five at the federal level. So we have race and color, familial status, disability, national origin, religion, and sex.
And when you say sex, male, female?
It extends beyond that, gender identity, and that's exactly what happened. So New York State says, look, I'm going to follow federal law, but I want to add on to that. And so New York State adds age to that. Citizenship status and immigration are added.
So if someone's not a citizen and they don't have lawful immigration status in the United States, they can still not be discriminated against?
Yeah, so let's come back to that. Let's finish the protected classes.
Okay, sorry about
that. No worries. There are seven protected categories at the federal level. I'm looking at my chart. My chart has federal, New York State, New York City, Nassau, and Suffolk. And there's actually 19 protected classes at this point because, again, we see these overlays. So, for example, New York City, as I mentioned before, is lawful occupation and height and weight as protected classes too. And sometimes people chuckle and say, well, I'm not going to discriminate against someone in terms of fair housing with respect to their height and weight. Well, number one, you can't, but also I also like to remind people that it's not only fair housing laws that have protected classes, there are employment laws, for example. So a lot of them go hand in hand. So when someone, you know, kind of chuckles about that, I was like, well, number one, you shouldn't discriminate against someone by virtue of their height and weight. But remember, it's not only fair housing, it's protected at other levels in other ways, including employment. That's New York City, as we talked about. Now, you asked a question about citizenship and immigration status. And the answer is, yeah, New York State says you can't discriminate against someone by virtue of them not being a citizen of the U.S. There is no law that says that someone has to live in the U.S. or be a citizen of the U.S. to own property here, to even be physically present here. Immigration status is also a protected class now. What does that mean? It means that if someone is here illegally, you can't ask them, are you here illegally? Now, it doesn't mean, so for example, if you're a landlord and you're qualifying someone, it doesn't mean that you can't qualify them financially, but you can't ask someone, do you have a green card? Do you have a visa? And so on. I reconcile the legislator's decision to do that with going back to the why of fair housing. Even if you're here illegally, in theory, you still need a shelter. You still need a place to live. Some landlords might argue with me and say, wait a minute, that puts me at a disadvantage. But you know, that'll be another conversation for another day, Bill. But in terms of evaluating and talking about these protected classes, yeah, it's important and that's why you said, well, it seems pretty simple. It seems pretty straightforward. And yet here we have these 19 classes and how you deal with someone who's disabled, whether you can ask someone if they have a green card, some of those questions or conversations or thoughts may seem to you very evident. But then when you take a look and you understand the complexities of fair housing law, you realize, well, you know what? It's not so straightforward. And I frequently joke, I would like to put myself out of business at some point, not having to teach this stuff. I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Now, I guess there are two ways that this can be enforced, either by the government saying you violated fair housing laws. So the Department of State, Division of Licensing Services in New York State, what other agencies would bring a case against an individual property owner or real estate agent or somebody else who was providing housing?
There are multiple ways that you could have a fair housing complaint filed against you. You could have a tenant that files a complaint. They could go to the New York State Division of Human Rights. They could go, and the Division of Human Rights might, if you're a real estate broker, might refer that then to the Department of State. You have the Attorney General's office. You have the local, you have New York City, New York City Commission on Human Rights. So there are different places that someone could go to make a complaint. So that could be an individual making a complaint. The other way that it could happen is through testing. Our governmental agencies do some testing, but they don't probably have enough enforcement power or resources, I should say. So we have nonprofit fair housing agencies that are out there. And those nonprofit fair housing agencies, they have fairly robust testing practices. And so they might do what's called, as I mentioned before, paired testing, which is sending two people and seeing how they're treated. Or you might just have someone, a single tester, calling up and simply saying, do you accept Section 8, and seeing what someone says. So there are lots of different ways that the enforcement could occur. Some of it is proactive, some of it is reactive.
Is this a criminal offense?
In most instances, they're civil offenses, carrying civil penalties. I don't believe that it's a criminal offense. But they're civil offenses, and they certainly can be very costly, as we talked about.
Neil, Realty Speak listeners love stories. Can you tell us some stories about some real landmark cases that either you've been involved in or that you know about?
The cases that I would talk about most, they seem very straightforward on their face, but they illustrate the importance of understanding this. So for example, Bill, you're a real estate broker and you might have a receptionist that is filling in for the person who normally answers your phones. And you get a very straightforward phone call. This person says, hey, do you accept Section 8? That's the most common example. And the person that you have sitting in the front doesn't even know. It says, you know, I don't think so. Let me check for you. Or no, we don't do that. Or so a bunch of the cases that I've been involved in are as simple as someone have no idea of what they are talking about.
Lack of education.
Total lack of education.
Everybody in the organization needs to be aware of this.
Right.
Everyone in the building that is supporting the building, the superintendent, the resident manager, the door person, the porter. I mean, every single one of these people could make a mistake inadvertently.
If you're asking me my training policies, that's what I would tell you, because those are the places that someone would have the contact. Standing, talking to a door person, who lives in the building? I go back to that. Those kind of stories are the stories that I share on a fairly regular basis. Those are the things that I see. And then I have my kind of golden rules, which is know what the fair housing laws are. If you think something violates fair housing laws, don't answer the question. You don't know an answer to a question, don't answer the question. Have a systematic approach to the way we conduct our business, which we've talked about. So there are just certain practices and processes that I relate in every class that I teach. I'm teaching tomorrow. I taught that last week. This is all I do pretty much all day long.
What are some of the questions that the audience ask? The typical question that the audience asks that you say, no, you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or why did you do that?
Great example would be pets. So pets are not a protected class. We have buildings that say no pets. There is no law that says that you have an obligation to rent to pets, and you could have a building that says no pets. The exception to that would be service animals and assistance animals. We get this question a lot. And first, you need to understand that there are really, under the law, only two definitions of these service animals. A service animal is an animal that is specifically trained to do something. And an assistance animal could be any animal, provided that it helps the disabled person meet the limitations of their disability. Well, what do we see all the time? Someone moves into a building and says, I have an emotional support animal. This is a question we get all the time. What does a building do? So the law says that the owner has the right to ask for proof of the disability. Now, I always say to the audience, okay, how many people have a pet? How many people have had a pet? Would everyone agree that a pet provides emotional support? Sure. You could define, in theory, any pet as an emotional support animal. Question is, does it meet the threshold question, which is, does the person that has the pet, do they have a diagnosable disability? So the landlord has the right to request some type of proof from a social worker, some type of healthcare professional, a doctor, that someone has a disability. Remember, you can't ask what the disability is, and then that the animal helps them meet the limitations of that disability. The thing that we see all the time is people trying to get around that, because you can go online, Bill, you could go to a website and you could print out a certificate for $35 that says that your animal is an emotional support animal. Probably not lying. It probably is emotional support animal, but does the owner have a diagnosable disability? And the problem that I have with this whole thing is that that if you do have a disability and you truly have an assistance animal or service animal, you shouldn't even have to talk about it. You should have the right. But we see people trying to take advantage of the system.
Someone brings a certificate to a property owner, the one you just mentioned, then they cannot discriminate and they have to allow the person to have the pet?
Under the definitions of the law, a service animal and assistance animal are not considered pets. Yes, if you move into a building, it's a no pet building. At any time, if you have that either assistance animal or service animal, and you can produce proof from a healthcare professional that you have a diagnosable disability and the animal helps you meet the limitations of that disability, then the landlord must abide by that.
Before we were talking about the pets or the service animal, we talked about some examples of violation of fair housing laws that appear more inadvertent than deliberate. What about some of the deliberate violation of fair housing laws? Any examples of that where people are actually deliberately violating fair housing laws, do not care, and then found themselves in a situation?
If you look at the Newsday investigation or cases out there, there are still many people out there, Bill, that are racist, that are not going to follow fair housing laws. I don't know that there's anything that I can do, teach, talk about that is ultimately going to change someone's position there, other than maybe the scared straight portion of my program, which I talk about the financial fines. So I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I don't focus my energies on people that I'm not going to have any ability to sway. I would say that 99% of the people that take my classes, though, have a true and real desire to follow the law, and they're there because they want to, and they don't want to make those mistakes. If you look at Newsday, go back and you'll see some of the statements that were made by brokers are really disheartening in terms, oh, you don't want to live there, or, oh, look at the faces on the school bus, or things like that, which are just blatantly racist. My constituency are people that I want to make sure they understand what the laws are so that they can comply with the law.
And that's a very valuable distinction that you just made there. And that's really why I wanted to do this episode, because my listener base, a lot of it is real estate brokers, a lot of it is property owners, a lot of it is property managers. And I guess I want to contribute in some way to all of them wanting to follow fair housing laws and not make that inadvertent mistake. And hopefully this will stimulate and motivate them to maybe take some of your courses, investigate it more, get legal counsel, and make sure that they don't do something that they shouldn't do and find themselves, like you said, getting scared straight because of the financial burden that it could cause for them. Well, Neil, that was not just fairly informative. That was extraordinarily informative. And please share with everyone how they can get in touch with you.
My email address is ngarfinkel@agmblaw.com. My phone number is 212-201-1173.
That's direct?
That's direct. And again, I talked about the toolbox, so it's www.toolbox4success.com. And our real estate school is www.rec4success.com.
And Realty Speak fans, that'll be in the show notes. So hopefully if you're listening to this while you're driving and not trying to write it down, and you'll be able to get the links in the show notes. So, Neil, before we close, I have one more question for you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be related to what we just spoke about. But if you woke up tomorrow and something in the world had changed, what do you wish it would be?
Well, let's keep it on par with this. On a very macro level, I wish that people followed the golden rule more, which is treat people the way that you'd like to be treated. So I would love to see that, because my experience is that we don't do that enough. With respect to fair housing, as I said, I would love to put myself out of business at some point so I don't have to teach this. But if you really want me to pinpoint, I would love to see the changes in the voucher recipients, and let's put those voucher recipients on equal footing. If I could do anything and be a change in the fair housing realm, it would be there, because I think that's the most important thing, and it would truly affect the tenants' lives, the owners' lives, the brokers' lives, the agents' lives, and that would be for the betterment. So yeah, so thank you for pinning me down a little bit. If I wake up tomorrow and we've solved that problem, that would be tremendous. That is my mission.
Thank you, Neil.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Love to come back and talk about another topic sometime.
Hopefully after that, what you wish would happen happens.
There you go.
Well, there you have it. Everyone, thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Realty Speak, the podcast. Please subscribe. Search for Realty Speak on your favorite podcast app like Podcast Republic, my fave on Android devices, or Apple Podcasts for an iPhone. Find it, open it, hit subscribe, and you're in. Spotify? Yes, you will find Realty Speak there as well. And don't forget to check out the show notes for information and links. Please help Realty Speak grow by sharing the show with others. How? Do an email blast. Include as part of your newsletter or on your website blog. Post from your LinkedIn, Facebook, and/or X profiles. And of course, if you'd like to talk about purchasing, selling, or financing investment real estate, having a New York City Local Law 152 inspection done, access past episodes, or just chat, you can contact me directly via the website at BillWeidner.com. That's BILLWEIDNER.com. And remember, it's not about us, but how we help you make the bottom line rise. Until next time.